Eventually, Killorn turns toward it, angling us on a diagonal to the shore, and then parallel. His advance is masterful, with the stolen boats at anchor to hide our approach. Once or twice, he touches my arm beneath the waves, communicating with a slight pressure. Stop. Go. Slow. Fast. All of it while he stays fixed on the dock ahead. Luckily, the freighter ship is unloading, drawing the attention of any soldiers who might spot our heads bobbing through the water. More crates, all white, stamped with the green triangle. More clothes? No, I realize as a crate topples, cracking open. Guns spill across the dock. Rifles, pistols, ammunition, probably a dozen in one crate alone. They gleam in the sunlight, newly made. Another gift for the Scarlet Guard. Another twist of even deeper roots I never knew existed. The knowledge makes me swim faster, pushing me past Killorn even when my muscles ache. I duck under the dock, safe at last from any eyes above, and he follows, keeping pace just behind me. It's right below us. His whispers echo oddly, reverberating off the metal dock and the water all around. I can just feel it with my toes. I almost laugh at the sight of Killorn stretching, his brow set in concentration as he tries to brush a foot against the hidden bunker of Barracks One. Something funny? He grumbles. You're so useful, I reply with a mischievous smirk. It feels good to be with him like this, sharing a secret goal again, although this time we're breaking into a military bunker, not someone's half-locked house. Here, he finally says, before his head disappears below the water. He bobs back up again, arms wide to keep himself afloat. The edge. Now comes the hard part. The plunge through suffocating, drowning darkness. Killorn reads the fear on my face plainly. Just hold on to my leg, that's all you have to do. I can barely nod. Right. The moon pool is on the bottom of the bunker, only 25 feet down. It's nothing at all, Farley had said. Well, it certainly looks like something, I think, peering at the black water below me. Killorn, Maven will be so disappointed if the ocean kills me before he can. To anyone else, the joke would be in poor taste, but Killorn chuckles lowly, his grin bright against the water. Well, as much as I'd like to annoy the king, he sighs, let's try and avoid drowning, shall we? With a wink, he dives, end over end, and I grab hold. The salt stings my eyes, but it's not so dark as I thought it would be. Sunlight angles through the water, breaking up the shadow cast by the dock above. And Killorn moves us quickly, pulling us down along the side of the barracks. The water-bent sunlight dapples his bare back, spotting him like a sea creature. I focus mainly on kicking, when I can, and not getting caught on anything. This is not 25 feet, my mind grumbles when the twinge of oxygen deprivation sets in. I exhale slowly, letting the bubbles rise past my face, up to the surface. Killorn's own breath streams past, the only testament to his strain. When he finds the bottom edge, I feel his muscles tense, and his legs kick along, powering us both beneath the hidden bunker. Dimly, I wonder if the moon pool has a door and if it'll be closed. What a joke that would be. Before I know what's happening, Killorn bursts up and through something, hauling me with him. Stuffy but blissful air hits my face, and I gulp it down in deep, greedy gasps. Already sitting on the edge of the pool, his legs dangling in the water, Killorn grins at me. You wouldn't last a morning on nodding nets, he says with a shake of the head. That was barely a bath compared to what old Cully used to make me do. You really know how to cut me deep, I reply dryly, hoisting myself up and into the colonel's chambers. The compartment is cold, lit by low lights, and offensively well organized. Old equipment is pushed neatly against the right wall, gathering dust, while a desk runs the length of the left. Stacks of files and papers crowd the surface in neat rows, dominating the space. At first I don't even see a bed, but it's there, a narrow bunk that rolls out from beneath the desk. Clearly the colonel doesn't sleep much. Killorn was always a slave to his curiosity, and now is no different. He drips his way over to the desk, ready to explore. "Don't touch anything," I hiss at him while I wring out my sleeves and pant legs. "Get one drop on those papers and he'll know someone was in here." He nods, pulling his hand back. "You should see this," he says, his tone sharp. I step to his side in an instant, fearing the worst. "What?" Careful, he points a finger at the only thing decorating the walls of the compartment. A photograph, warped by age and damp, but the faces are still visible. Four figures, all blonde, posing with stern but open expressions. The colonel is there, barely recognizable without his bloody eye, one arm around a tall, well-boned woman, and his hand on a young girl's shoulder. Both the woman and the girl wear dirt-stained clothes, farmers by the look of it, but the gold chains at their necks say differently. Silently, I remove the gold chain from my pocket, comparing the metal so fine it could be thread to the necklaces in the picture. But for the mismatched key dangling from the end, they are identical. Gently, Kinlorn takes the key from my hand, puzzling over what it could mean. The third figure explains it all. A teenager, with a long golden braid. She stands shoulder to shoulder with the colonel and wears a smirk of satisfaction. She looks so young, so different without her short hair and scars. Farley. She's his daughter, Kinlorn says aloud, too shocked for much else. I resist the urge to touch the photograph to make sure it's real. The way he treated her back in the infirmary, it can't possibly be true. But he called her Diana. He knew her real name. And they had the necklaces, one from a sister, one from a wife. "Come on," I murmur, pulling him away from the picture. "It's nothing to bother with now." "Why didn't she say anything?" In his voice, I hear a little bit of the betrayal I've felt for days. "I don't know." I keep hold of him, moving us both toward the compartment door. Left down the stairs, right at the landing, left again. The door swings open on oiled hinges, revealing an empty passage quite like the ones on the Mercif. Sparse and clean, with metal walls and piping above us. Electricity bleeds overhead, pumping through a wired network of veins. It's coming from the shore, feeding the lights and other machinery. Like Farley said, there's no one down here. No one to stop us. I suppose, as the colonel's daughter, she would know firsthand. Quiet as cats, we follow her instructions, mindful of every single step. I'm reminded of the cells beneath the Hall of the Sun, where Julian and I incapacitated a squadron of black-masked sentinels to free Killorn, Farley, and the doomed Walsh. It seems so far away. Yet that was only days ago. A week. Just 1 week. I shudder to think where I'll be in 7 more days. At last we come to a shorter passage, a dead end with 3 doors on the left, 3 doors on the right, and just as many observation windows set in between. The glass of each is dark but for the window on the end. It flickers slightly, casting harsh white light through the pane. A fist collides with the glass and I flinch, expecting it to crack beneath Cal's knuckles. But the window holds firm, echoing dully with every boom-boom of his fists, showing nothing more than smears of silver blood. No doubt he hears me coming and thinks I'm one of them. When I step in front of the window, he freezes mid-motion, one clenched and bleeding fist poised to strike. His flame-maker bracelet slides down his thick wrist, still spinning from his momentum. That's a comfort, at least. They didn't know enough to take away his greatest weapon. But then why is he still imprisoned at all? Couldn't he just melt the window and be done with it? For a single blazing moment, our eyes meet through the glass, and I think our combined stare might shatter it. Thick, silver blood drips from where he struck his hand, mixing with already dried stains. He's been at this for a while, beating himself bloody in an attempt to get out or burn off a little bit of his rage. "It's locked," he says, his voice muffled behind the glass. Couldn't tell, I reply, smirking. Next to me, Killorn holds up the key. Cal starts as if noticing Killorn for the first time. He smiles, grateful. But Killorn doesn't return the gesture. He won't even meet his eyes. From somewhere down the hall, I hear shouting, footsteps. They echo strangely in the bunker, but grow closer with every heartbeat. Coming for us. They know we're here, Killorn hisses, looking back. Quickly, he jams the key in the lock and turns it. It doesn't budge, and I throw my shoulder against the door, slamming into cold, unforgiving iron. Killorn forces the key again, twisting. This time I'm close enough to hear the mechanism click. The door swings inward as the first soldier rounds the corner, but my thoughts are only of Cal. It seems princes make me blind. The invisible curtain drops the moment Killorn shoves me into the cell. It's a familiar sensation, but I can't place it. I felt it before. I know I have. But where? I don't have time to wonder. Cal surges past me, a strangled yell erupting from his lips, his long arms outstretched. Not to me or the window, to the door as it yanks shut. The click of the lock echoes inside my skull, again and again and again. What? I ask the heavy, stale air. But the only answer I need is Killorn's face, staring at me from the other side of the glass. The key hangs from one clenched fist, and his face curls into something between a scowl and a sob. I'm sorry, he mouths, and the first Lakelander soldier appears through the window. More follow, flanking the colonel. His satisfied smirk matches the one his daughter wore in the photograph, and I begin to understand what just happened. The colonel even has the audacity to laugh. Cal hurls himself at the door in vain, driving his shoulder against solid iron. He swears through the pain, cursing Killorn, me, this place, himself. I barely hear him over Julian's voice in my head. Anyone can betray anyone. Without thought, I call for the lightning. My sparks will free me and turn the colonel's laughter into screams. But they don't come. There's nothing. Bleak nothing. Like in the cells, like the arena. Silent stone, Cal says, leaning heavily against the door. He points with one bloody fist to back corners of the floor and ceiling. They have silent stone. To make you weak. To make you like them. Now it's my turn to pound my fists against the window, punching at Killorn's head. But I hit glass, not flesh, and hear only the cracking of my own knuckles instead of his stupid skull. Despite the wall between us, he flinches. He can barely look at me. He shivers when the colonel puts one hand on his shoulder, whispering into his ear. Killorn can only watch as I scream, an indecipherable roar of frustration, and my blood joins Cal's on the glass. Red running through silver, joining into something darker. 8. The legs of the metal chair scrape against the floor, the only sound in the square cell. I leave the other chair where it lies, upended and battered after being thrown against the wall. Cal did quite a number on the cell before I got here, hurling both chairs and a now-dented table. There's a single chink in the wall, just below the window, where the corner of the table hit home. But throwing furniture is no use to me. Instead of wasting my energy, I conserve it and take a seat in the center of the room. Cal paces back and forth before the window, more animal than man. Every inch of him yearns for fire. Killorn is long gone, having left with his new friend, the colonel. And I am revealed for exactly what I am. A particularly stupid fish, constantly moving from hook to hook, never learning my lesson. But next to the Hall of the Sun, Archeon, and the Bowl of Bones, this might as well be a vacation, and the colonel is nothing compared to the queen or a line of executioners. You should sit, I tell Cal, finally growing tired of his vengeful intensity, unless you plan on wearing your way through the floor. He scowls, annoyed, but stops moving all the same. Instead of pulling up a chair, he leans against the wall in a childish act of defiance. I'm starting to think you like prisons, he says, idly knocking his knuckles against the wall, and that you have the worst taste in men.
That stings more than I'd like it to.
Yes, I cared for Maven, cared for him far more than I want to admit, and Killorn is my closest friend. They are betrayers both.
You're not too good at choosing friends either, I fire back, but it glances off him harmlessly.
And I don't have, the words jumble, coming out wrong and stilted, any taste in men. This has nothing to do with that.
Nothing?
He chuckles, almost amused.
Who were the last two people to lock us in a cell?
When I don't reply, shamed, he presses on.
Admit it. You've got a hard time keeping your heart and your head separated.
I stand so fast, the chair falls backward, clanging against the floor.
Don't act like you didn't love Maven, like you didn't let your heart make decisions where he was concerned. He is my brother. Of course I was blind to him. Of course I didn't think he would kill our father.
His voice breaks at the memory, letting me glimpse the ragged and broken child beneath the facade of a warrior.
I made mistakes because of him, and,
he adds quietly,
I made mistakes because of you.
So did I. The worst was when I put my hand in his, letting him pull me from my bedroom into a dance and a downward spiral. I let the guard kill innocents for Cal, to keep him from going to war, to keep him close to me. My selfishness had a horrible cost.
We can't do that anymore. Make mistakes for each other,
I whisper, skirting around what I really mean, what I've been trying to tell myself for days now. Cal is not a path I should choose or want. Cal is simply a weapon, something for me to use, or something for others to use against me. I must prepare for both. After a long moment, he nods. I get the feeling he sees me in the same way. The damp of the barracks sets in, joining the cold still deep in my bones. Normally I would shiver, but I'm getting used to this feeling. I suppose I should get used to being alone, too. Not in the world, but in here. In my heart. Part of me wants to laugh at our predicament. Again, I am side by side with Cal, in a cell, waiting for whatever fate has in store for us. But this time, my fear is tempered by anger. It won't be Maven coming to gloat, but the Colonel, and for that I'm terribly thankful. Maven's taunts are not ones I ever want to suffer again. Even the thought of him hurts. The bowl of bones was dark, empty, a deeper prison than this. Maven stood out sharply, his skin pale, eyes bright, his hands reaching for mine. In the poisoned memory, they flicker between soft fingers and ragged claws. Both want to make me bleed. I told you to hide your heart once. You should have listened. They were his last words to me, before he sentenced us to execution. I wish it hadn't been such good advice. Slowly I exhale, hoping to expel the memories with my breath. It doesn't work. So, what do we do about this, General Killorn? I ask, gesturing to the four walls holding us prisoner. Now I can see the slight outlines in the corners, the square blocks a bit darker than the rest, fixed right into the panels of the walls. After a long moment, Cal pulls out of thoughts just as painful as mine. Glad for the distraction, he rights the other chair swiftly, pushing it against a corner. He steps up, almost banging his head on the ceiling, and runs a hand over the silent stone. It's more dangerous to us than anything on this island, more damaging than any weapon.
By my colors, how did they get this?
He mutters, his fingers trying to find an edge. But the stone lies flush, perfectly embedded. With a sigh, he jumps back down and faces the observation window. Our best chance is breaking the glass. There's no getting around these in here.
It's weaker, though,
I say, staring at the silent stone. It stares right back. In the bowl of bones, I felt like I was suffocating. This is nowhere near that bad. Cal shrugs. Not as many blocks here, but still enough.
Stolen?
They have to be.
There's only so much silent stone, and only the government can use it for obvious reasons.
That's true.
In Norta. He tilts his head, perplexed.
You think these came from somewhere else?
There are smuggled shipments coming in from all over. Piedmont, the Lakelands, other places too. And haven't you seen any soldiers down here, their uniforms?
He shakes his head.
No, not since that red-eyed bastard marched me in yesterday. They call him the Colonel, and he's Farley's father.
I'd feel sorry for her, but my family's infinitely worse.
I scoff, half amused. They're Lakelanders, Cal. Farley, and the Colonel, and all his soldiers. Which means there's more where they came from. Confusion clouds his face.
That can't be. I've seen the battle lines myself. There's no way through.
He looks at his hands, idly drawing a map in midair. It makes no sense to me, but he knows it intimately.
The lakes are blockaded on both shores. The choke is out of the question completely. Moving goods and stores is one thing, but not people, not in this magnitude. They'd have to have wings to get across.
My breath rushes inward as fast as my realization. The concrete yard, the immense hangar at the end of the base, the wide road leading to nowhere.
Not a road.
A runway.
I think they do.
To my surprise, a wide, genuine grin breaks across Cal's face. He turns to the window, peering out at the empty passage.
Their manners leave a lot to be desired, but the Scarlet Guard are going to cause my brother a lot of headaches.
And then I'm smiling, too. If this is how the Colonel treats his so-called allies, I'd love to see what he does to his enemies. Dinner time comes and goes, marked only by a grizzled old Lakelander carrying a tray of food. He motions for both of us to step back and face the far wall so he can slide the tray through a slit in the door. Neither of us responds, stubbornly standing our ground by the window. After a long standoff, he marches away, eating our dinner with a grin. It doesn't bother me in the slightest. I grew up hungry. I could handle a few hours without a meal. Cal, on the other hand, pales when the food saunters off, his eyes following the plate of gray fish.
If you wanted to eat, you should have told me, I grumble, taking my seat again.
You're no use if you're starving.
That's what they're supposed to think, he replies with a bit of a glint in his eye. I figure I'll faint after breakfast tomorrow and see how well their medics take a punch.
It's a shaky plan at best, and I wrinkle my nose in distaste.
Do you have a better idea?
No, I say, sullen.
That's what I thought.
The silent stone has a strange effect on both of us. In taking away what we rely on most, our abilities, the cell forces us to become someone else. For Cal, that means being smarter, more calculating. He can't lean on infernos, so he turns to his mind instead. Although judging by the fainting idea, he's not the sharpest blade in the armory. The change in me is not so evident. After all, I lived 17 years in silence, not knowing what power lingered within me. Now I'm remembering that girl again. The heartless, selfish girl who would do anything to save her own skin. If the Lakelander returns with another tray, he better be ready to feel my hands around his throat. And if we manage to get out of this cell, my lightning in his bones. Julian's alive. I don't know where the words come from, but suddenly they're hanging in the air, fragile as snowflakes. Cal's head jerks up, his eyes suddenly bright. The prospect of his uncle still breathing cheers him almost as much as freedom.
Who told you that?
The Colonel.
Now it's Cal's turn to,
I think I believe him. That earns a disparaging glare, but I press on. The Colonel thinks Julian was part of Maven's trap. Another silver to betray me. It's why he doesn't believe in the list.
Cal nods, his eyes far away. The ones like you.
Farley calls them us new bloods.
Well, he sighs, the only thing they'll be called is dead if you don't get out of here soon. Maven will hunt them all.
Blunt, but true. For revenge? To my surprise, he shakes his head.
He's a new king following a murdered father.
Not the most stable place to start his reign. The high houses, Samos and Iral especially, would leap at a chance to weaken him. And the discovery of new bloods, after he publicly denounced you, would certainly do that. Though Cal was raised to be a soldier trained in the barracks of a living war, he was also born to be a king. He might not be so conniving as Maven, but he understands statecraft better than most. So every person we save will hurt him, not just on the battlefield, but on the throne. He smirks crookedly, leaning his head back against the wall.
You're throwing we around quite a bit.
Does that bother you? I ask, testing the waters. If I can rope Cal into tracking down the new bloods with me, we might actually have a chance of outpacing Maven. A muscle in his cheek twitches, the only indication of his indecision. He doesn't get a chance to answer before the now familiar march of boots cuts him off. Cal groans to himself, annoyed at the colonel's return. When he starts to rise, my hand shoots out, pushing him back into his seat. Don't stand for him, I mutter, leaning back in my own chair. Cal does as he's told and settles in, arms crossed over his broad chest. Now, instead of beating against the window and tossing tables at the walls, he looks stoic, serene, a boulder of flesh waiting to crush whoever comes too close. If only he could. But for the silent stone, he would be a blazing inferno, burning hotter and brighter than the sun. And I would be a storm. Instead, we're reduced to our bones, to two teenagers grumbling in a cage. I do my best to keep still when the colonel appears in the window. I don't want to give him the satisfaction of my anger. But when Killorn appears at his shoulder, his expression cold and stern, my body jolts. Now it's Cal's turn to hold me back, his hand a slight pressure on my thigh, keeping me seated. The colonel stares for a moment, as if memorizing the sight of the prince and the lightning girl imprisoned. I'm seized by the urge to spit on the blood-stained glass, but refrain. Then he turns away from us, gesturing with long, crooked fingers. They twitch once, twice, beckoning for someone to step forward, or be brought forth. She fights like a lion, forcing the colonel's bodyguards to hold her clean off the ground. Farley's fist catches one of them in the jaw, sending him sprawling, breaking his grip on her arm. She slams the other into the passage wall, crushing his neck between her elbow and the window of another cell. Her blows are brutal, meant to inflict as much damage as she can, and I can see purple bruises already blooming on her captors. But the bodyguards are careful not to hurt her, doing their best to keep her merely restrained. Colonel's orders, I suppose. He'll give his daughter a cell, but not bruises. To my dismay, Killorn doesn't stand idle. When the guards get her up against a wall, each one bracing a shoulder and leg, the colonel gestures to the fish boy. With shaking hands, he pulls out a dull gray box. Syringes gleam within. I can't hear her voice through the glass, but it's easy to read her lips. No, don't. Killorn, stop it! The window is suddenly cold and smooth beneath my hand. I beat against it, trying to catch his attention. Killorn! But he squares his shoulders, turning his back so I can't see his face. The colonel does the opposite, staring at me instead of the syringe plunging into his daughter's neck. Something strange flickers deep in his good eye. Regret? Maybe? No. This is not a man with doubts. He'll do whatever he must, to whoever he must. Killorn pulls back after doing the deed, the empty syringe sharp in his hand. He waits, watching Farley thrash against her captors. But her movements slow and her eyelids droop as the drugs take hold. Finally, she sags against the Lakelander guards, unconscious, and they drag her to the cell across from mine. They lay her down before locking the door, shutting her in just like Cal, just like me. When her door clangs shut, the lock in mine clicks open.
Redecorating, the colonel says with a sniff,
eyeing the dented table as he enters. Killorn follows, tucking the box of syringes back into his coat, in warning. For you, if you step out of line. He avoids my stare, busying himself with the box, while the door locks behind them, leaving the two guards to man the passage on the other side. Cal glares from his seat, his expression murderous. I don't doubt he's thinking about all the ways he could kill the Colonel, and which would hurt the most. The Colonel knows that too, and draws a short but lethal pistol from its holster. It idles in his hand, a coiled snake waiting to strike.
"Please sit, Miss Barrow,"
he says, gesturing with the gun. Obeying his command feels like surrender, but I have no other choice. I take my seat, letting Killorn and the Colonel stand over us. If not for the gun and the guards in the hall, watching closely, we might have a chance. The Colonel is tall but older, and Cal's hands would fit nicely around his throat. I would have to take Killorn myself, relying on my knowledge of his still-healing wounds to bring the traitor down. But once we bested them, the door would still be locked, the guards still watching. Our fight would accomplish nothing at all. The Colonel smirks, as if reading my thoughts.
"Best stay in your chair."
"You need a gun to keep two children in line?" I scoff back at him, angling my chin at the pistol in his hand. There isn't a soul on Earth who would dare call Cal a child, even without his abilities. His military training alone makes him deadly, something the Colonel knows well enough. He ignores the insult and plants his feet in front of me, so his bloody eye bores into mine.
"You know, you're lucky I'm a progressive man. There aren't many who would let him live."
He nods toward Cal, before sweeping back to me.
"And a few who would kill you as well."
I glance at Killorn, hoping he realizes what side he's on. He fidgets like a little boy. If we were children again, still the same size, I would punch him squarely in the stomach.
"You're not keeping me around for the pleasure of my company," Cal says, cutting right through the Colonel's dramatics. "So what are you going to trade me for?"
The Colonel's reaction is the only confirmation I need. His jaw clenches, tightening in anger. He wanted to say the words himself, but Cal's taken the wind out of his sails.
"Trade,"
I murmur, though it comes out more like a hiss.
"You're going to trade away one of the best weapons you've got? How stupid are you?"
"Not stupid enough to think he'll fight for us,"
the Colonel replies.
"No, I leave that foolish hope to you, Lightning Girl."
Don't rise to the bait, it's what he wants. Still, it takes everything in me to stare straight ahead and keep my eyes from Cal. Truthfully, I don't know where his loyalties lie or who he fights for. I only know who he'll fight against. Maven. Some would think that puts us on the same side, but I know better. Life and war are not so simple as that.
"Very well, Colonel Farley."
He flinches when I use his last name. His head turns slightly, resisting the urge to look back at his daughter, unconscious in her cell. "There's pain there," I note, filing it away for later use. But the Colonel responds to my jab in kind.
"The King has put forth a bargain," he says, his words pressing like a knife on the verge of drawing blood. "In exchange for the exiled prince, King Maven has agreed to reinstate the traditional age of conscription, back to 18, instead of 15 years old." He lowers his eyes, his voice dropping with them. For a brief, splintering moment, I catch a glimpse of the father beneath the brutal exterior. His mind wanders to the children sent to die.
"It's a good deal."
"Too good," I say quickly, my tone hard and strong enough to hide the fear beneath. "Maven will never honor such a trade. Never." To my left, Cal exhales slowly. He draws his hands together, fingers steepled, displaying the many cuts and bruises he's earned over the last few days. They twitch in succession, one after the other, a distraction from whatever truth he's trying to avoid.
"But you have no choice," Cal says, his hands finally still. "Turning down the deal dooms them all."
The Colonel nods.
"Indeed. Take heart, Tiberius. Your death will save thousands of innocent children. They are the only reason you're still breathing."
Thousands. Certainly they're worth, Cal, certainly. But deep in my heart, in the twisted, cold part of myself I'm starting to know all too well, something disagrees. Cal is a fighter, a leader, a killer, a hunter. And you need him. In more ways than one. Something glitters in Cal's eye. If not for the silent stone, I know his hands would shudder with flame. He leans forward slightly, lips pulling back against his even white teeth. It's so aggressive and animalistic, I expect to see fangs.
I am your rightful king. Silverborn for centuries.
He replies, seething.
The only reason you're still breathing is because I can't burn the oxygen from this room.
I've never heard such a threat from Cal. So visceral, it cuts my insides. And the colonel, usually calm and stoic, feels it as well. He pulls back too quickly, almost stumbling into Killorn. Like Farley, he's embarrassed by his fear. For a moment, his complexion matches his bloody eye, making him look like a tomato with limbs. But the colonel is made of sterner stuff and chases away his fear in a single, collected moment. He smooths back his white blonde hair, pressing it flat to his skull, and holsters his gun with a satisfied sigh.
Your boat leaves tonight, Your Royal Highness, he says with a crack of his neck. I advise you to say goodbye to Miss Barrow. I doubt you'll see her ever again.
My hand closes around the seat of my chair, digging into the cold, rough metal. If only my name was Evangeline Samos, then I would wrap this chair around the colonel's throat until he tasted iron and saw blood in both eyes.
What about Mare?
Even now, on the heels of his own death sentence, how is Cal stupid enough to worry about me?
She'll be watched.
Killorn butts in, speaking for the first time since he entered my cage. His voice quivers as it should. The coward has everything to be afraid of, including me.
Guarded, but not hurt.
Distaste flickers across the colonel's face. I suppose he wants me dead, too. Who could overrule him? I don't know. Farley's mysterious command, perhaps? Whoever they are.
Is that what you'll do to people like me?
I spit, feeling myself rise from my seat. The new bloods? Are you going to bring Shade down here next and put him in a cage like some sort of pet? Until we learn to obey?
That depends on him.
The colonel replies evenly, each word a cold kick in the gut.
He's been a good soldier, so far. Just like your friend here, he adds, putting one flat hand on Killorn's shoulder.
He reeks of fatherly pride, something Killorn's been without. After so long an orphan, even a father as horrible as the colonel must feel good.
Without him, I would have never had the excuse or the opportunity to lock you up.
I can only glare at Killorn, hoping my gaze hurts him as much as he's hurt me.
How proud you must be!
Not yet, the fish boy replies. If not for our years in the stilts, our many hours thieving and slinking like alley rats, I would have never seen it. But Killorn is easy to read, for me at least. When he angles his body, simultaneously arching his back and shrugging his hips, it looks natural. But there's nothing natural about what he's trying to do. The bottom of his jacket sags, outlining the box holding the syringes. It slips dangerously, sliding between the fabric and the stomach, faster and faster.
Oh!
He chokes out, jumping from the colonel's grasp when the box springs free. It bursts open in midair, spitting needles as it falls. They hit the floor, shattering and spilling fluid across our toes. Most would think them all broken, but my quick eyes notice one syringe still intact, half hidden by Killorn's curling fist.
Damn it, boy,
the colonel says, stooping without a thought. He reaches for the box, hoping to salvage something, but gets a needle in the neck for his trouble. The surprise of it gives Killorn the second he needs to squeeze, emptying the syringe into the colonel's veins. Like Farley, he fights, cracking Killorn across the face. He goes flying, colliding with the far wall. Before the colonel can take another step, Cal explodes out of his chair and slams him against the observation window. The Lakelander soldiers look on helplessly from the other side of the glass, their guns ready but useless. After all, they can't open the door. They can't risk letting the monsters out of their cage. The combination of the drugs and Cal's dead weight knocks the colonel out cold.
He slides down the window, knees buckling beneath him, and slumps into a very undignified pile. With his eyes closed, he looks much less threatening. Normal, even. Ow! Sounds from the wall where Kaloran stands, massaging his cheek. Drugged or not, the colonel packs a mean punch. A bruise has already begun to form. Without thought, I take quick steps toward him. It's nothing, Mayor, don't worry. But I'm not coming to comfort him. My fist collides with the opposite cheek, knuckles knocking against bone. He howls, moving with the momentum of my punch, almost losing his balance altogether. Ignoring the pain in my fist, I brush my hands together. Now you match! And then I embrace him, arms closing around his middle. He flinches, expecting more pain, but soon relaxes against my touch. They were going to catch you down here either way. Figured I'd do more good if I wasn't in the cell next to you. He heaves a sigh. I told you to trust me. Why didn't you believe it? For that, I have no answer. At the observation window, Cal sighs aloud, drawing the attention back to the task at hand. I can't fault your bravery, but does this plan go much further than singing this sack of scum a lullaby? He toes the colonel's body with a foot while jabbing a thumb at the window, indicating the guards still watching us. Just 'cause I can't read doesn't mean I'm stupid, Killorn says, a bit of an edge to his voice. Watch the window, should be any second. 10 seconds, to be exact. We stare for exactly 10 seconds before a familiar form appears, blinking into existence. Shade, looking much better than the brother I saw in the infirmary just this morning. He stands on his own 2 feet, with a brace on his injured leg and nothing more than bandages around his shoulder. He wields a crutch like a club, bashing both the guards before they get a chance to realize what's going on. They drop to the floor like sacks of hammers, stupid looks on their faces. The lock of the cell opens with a joyous echo, and Cal is at the door in a heartbeat, wrenching it open. He steps out into the air of the passage, breathing deep. I can't follow him fast enough, and sigh aloud when the weight of silent stone drops away. With a grin, I pull sparks to my fingers, watching them crackle in vain across my skin. Missed you, I murmur to my dearest friends. You're a strange one, Lightning Girl. To my surprise, Farley leans against her open cell door, the picture of calm. She doesn't look at all affected by the drugs, if they had any effect at all. The benefit of befriending nurses, Killorn says, bumping my shoulder. A nice smile was all it took to distract Lena and slip something harmless into the box. She'll be heartbroken to find you gone, Farley replies, twisting her lips into something akin to a pout. Poor girl. Killorn only scoffs. His eyes flicker to me. That's not my problem. And now? Cal says, the soldier in him coming forth. His shoulders tense, firm beneath his threadbare clothes, and he turns his neck back and forth, keeping an eye on every corner of the passage. Shade puts out his arm in response, palm pointed toward the ceiling. Now we jump, he says. I'm the first to put my hand on his arm, holding tight. Even if I can't trust Killorn, Cal, or anyone else, I can trust in ability, in strength. In power. With Cal's fire, my storm, and Shade's speed, nothing and no one can touch us. While we are together, I will never suffer a prison again. 9. The bunker passes by in flashes of light and color. I catch only glimpses as Shade lets loose, jumping us through the structure. His hands and arms are everywhere, grasping, giving us all enough space to hold on. He must be strong enough to take us all, because no one gets left behind. I see a door, a wall, the floor tipping toward me. Guards give chase at every turn, shouting, shooting, but we're never in one place long enough. Once, we land in a crowded room blossoming with electricity, surrounded by video screens and radio equipment. I even catch sight of some cameras piled in the corner before the occupants react to us and we jump away. Then, I'm squinting in the sunlight of the dock. This time, the Lakelanders get close enough that I can see their faces, pale against the evening light. Then it's sand beneath my feet. Another jump, and it's concrete.
We jump farther, in the open, starting at one end of the runway before teleporting all the way to the hangar. Shade winces with the strain, his muscles tight, the cords of his neck standing out starkly. One last jump takes us inside the hangar to face cool air and relative quiet. When the world finally stops twisting and pulling, I feel like collapsing or throwing up. But Killorn keeps me standing, holding me up to see what we've come so far for. Two air jets dominate the hangar, their wings spread wide and dark. One is smaller than the other, built for a single occupant, with a silver body and orange-tipped wings. Snapdragon, I remember, thinking back to Naersi and the swift, lethal jets that rained fire down upon us. The bigger one is pitch black, menacing, with a larger body and no distinguishing colors to speak of. I've never seen anything like it, and dimly wonder if Cal has either. After all, he's going to be the one to fly it, unless Farley has yet another skill in her bag of tricks. Judging by the way she stares at the jet, her eyes wide, I doubt it. What are you doing in here? The voice echoes strangely in the hangar, bouncing off the walls. The man who appears beneath the wing of the Snapdragon doesn't have the look of a soldier, wearing gray coveralls instead of a Lakelander uniform. His hands are black with oil, marking him as a mechanic. He glances between us, taking in Killorn's bruising cheeks and Shade's crutch. I'll have to report you to your superiors. Report away, Farley barks, looking every inch the captain she was. Next to her scar and the tense cut of her jaw, I'm surprised the mechanic doesn't faint on the spot. We're on strict orders from the colonel, she gestures quickly, pointing Cal toward the black jet. Now get this hangar door open. The mechanic continues to stammer, while Cal leads us to the rear of the jet. As we pass beneath the wing, he reaches up a hand, letting it drag against the cool metal. A black run, he explains quietly. Big and fast. And stolen, I add. He nods, stoic, reaching the same conclusion as me. From the Delphi airfield. A training exercise, Queen Alara had said at a luncheon long ago. She brushed aside the rumor of stolen jets with a wave of her salad fork, humiliating the now-dead Colonel Macanthos in front of her trove of ladies. I thought she was lying then, covering up more of the guard's actions, but it also seemed impossible. Who could steal a jet, let alone two? Apparently the Scarlet Guard could, and did. The back of the Black Run, beneath the tail, yawns open like a mouth, creating a ramp for loading and unloading cargo, namely, us. Shade goes first, leaning heavily on his crutch, his face damp and pale with exertion. So many jumps have taken their toll. Killorn follows, dragging me along with Cal right beside us. I can still hear the echo of Farley's voice when we clamber inside, navigating through semi-darkness. Seats line both curved walls, with heavy-duty straps dangling from each one. Enough to transport 24 men, at least. I wonder where this jet flew last and who it carried. Did they live? Did they die? And will we share their fate? Mare, I need you up here, Cal says, pushing past me to the front of the jet. He drops heavily into the pilot's seat, facing an unfathomable panel of buttons, levers, and instruments. All the dials and gauges are pointed to zero, and the jet hums with nothing but the beating of our own hearts. Through the thick glass of the cockpit, I can see the hangar door, still closed, and Farley still arguing with the mechanic. Sighing, I take the seat next to him and begin to strap myself in. What can I do? The buckles click and snap as I tighten each one in turn. If we're going to be flying, I don't want to be bouncing around the inside of the jet. This thing's got batteries, but they need a kick, and I don't think that mechanic's going to give it to us, he says with a bit of a glint in his eye. Do what you do best. Right. Determination floods through me, strong as my sparks. It's just like switching on a lamp or a camera, I tell myself, only a lot bigger and more complicated and more important. Briefly, I wonder if it can be done, if I'm enough to jumpstart the massive black run. But the memory of Lightning, purple and white and powerful, streaking out of the sky to strike the bowl of bones, tells me I am. If I can start a storm, I can certainly bring this jet to life. Arms outstretched, I put my hands on the panel. I don't know what to feel for, only that I feel nothing. My fingers dance along the metal, searching for anything to latch onto, anything I might be able to use. My sparks rise in my skin, ready to be called on. "Cal," I mutter through gritted teeth, reluctant to let the cry escape. He understands and works quickly, reaching under the control panel to something beneath. Metal tears with a biting screech, melted at the edges, as he pries away the panel casing. He reveals a mess of wires, crossing in woven bundles, and I'm reminded of veins beneath skin. I only need to get them pumping. Without thought, I plunge a hand into the wires, letting my sparks pulse out. They search on their own, looking for somewhere to go. When my fingers brush a particularly thick wire, a round, smooth cord that fits my hand perfectly, I can't help but smile. My eyes fall shut, allowing me to concentrate. I push harder, letting my strength flow into the power line. It carries through the jet, splitting and branching along different paths, but I force my sparks on. When they hit the engine and the immense batteries, my grip tightens, nails digging into skin. Come on. I can feel myself pour into the batteries, flooding them, until I brush against their own stored energy. My head dips, leaning against the panel, letting the cool metal calm my flushing skin. With one last push, the dam inside the jet breaks, bursting through the walls and wires. I don't see the black run power to life, but I feel it all around.
Well done, Cal says, sparing a second to squeeze my shoulder.
His touch doesn't linger, though, in accordance with our agreement. No distractions, least of all now. I open my eyes to see his hands dancing across the panel controls, flipping switches and adjusting knobs seemingly at random. When I lean back, another hand takes my shoulder. Killorn lets his hand rest, but his touch is strangely gentle. He's not even looking at me but the jet, his face torn between awe and fear. With his mouth agape and eyes wide, he looks almost childish. I feel small myself, sitting in the belly of an air jet, about to do what we never dreamed possible. The fish boy and the lightning girl, about to fly.
Does she expect me to ram this thing through a wall?
Cal mutters under his breath, his own smile long gone. He looks over his shoulder, eyes searching, not for me, but my brother.
Shade?
My brother looks liable to faint and reluctantly shakes his head.
I can't jump things this big, this complicated, even on a good day.
It pains him to say such a thing, though he has no reason at all to be ashamed. But Shade is a barrow, and we do not like to admit weakness.
I can grab Farley, though,
he continues, his hands straying to his buckles. Killorn knows my brother as well as I do, and pushes him back into his seat.
You're no use dead, Barrow, he says, forcing a crooked grin. I'll get that door open.
Don't bother, I spit out, my eyes fixed outside the cockpit. I push my power outward, and with a great screeching groan, the hangar door starts to open, pulling up from the floor in a smooth, steady motion. The mechanic looks puzzled, watching the mechanism controlling the door grind away, while Farley bolts. She sprints out of sight, racing the rising door. A blaze of sunset follows her, cut with streaking long shadows. 2 dozen soldiers stand in silhouette, blocking the opening. Not just Lakelanders, but Farley's own guardsmen, marked by their red sashes and scarves. Each one has a gun aimed at the Black Run, but they hesitate, not willing to fire. To my relief, I don't recognize Bree or Tramie among them. One of the Lakelanders steps forward, a captain or lieutenant, judging by the white stripes on his uniform. He shouts something, a hand outstretched, his lips forming the word stop. But we can't hear him above the growing roar of engines.
Go!
Farley shouts, appearing at the back of the plane. She hurtles into the closest seat, buckling herself in with shaking hands. Cal doesn't need to be told twice. His hands work double time, twisting and pressing, as if this is second nature. But I hear him muttering under his breath, like a prayer, reminding himself of what to do. The Black Run lurches forward, wheels rolling, while the rear ramp rises into place, sealing the interior of the craft with a satisfying pneumatic hiss. No going back now.
All right, let's get this thing moving,
Cal says, settling back into his pilot's chair with an almost excited twist. Without warning, he grabs a lever on the panel, pushing it forward, and the jet obeys. It rolls ahead, on a collision course with a line of soldiers. I grit my teeth, expecting a brutal scene. But they're already running, fleeing the Black Run and her vengeful pilot. We tear from the hangar, gaining speed with every passing second, to find the runway in chaos. Transports roar past the barracks, heading for us, while a troop of soldiers fires boldly from the roof of the hangar. The bullets ping into the metal hull, but never puncture it. The Black Run is made of stronger stuff and pushes on, turning a hard right that rattles us in our seats. Killorn gets the brunt of it, not having fastened his safety belts properly. His head bangs against the curved wall and he curses, cradling his bruised cheeks.
"You sure you can fly this thing?"
he growls, directing all his anger at Cal. With a sneer, Cal pushes further, urging the jet to its top speed. Out the window, I see the transports falling away, unable to keep pace. But ahead, the runway, a bland gray road, is steadily coming to an end. Soft green hills and stunted trees have never looked so menacing.
"Cal," I breathe, hoping he hears me over the scream of engines. "Cal."
Behind me, Killorn fumbles with his belt, but his fingers are shaking too badly to be of any use.
"Barrow, you got one last jump in you?" he shouts, glancing at my brother.
Shade doesn't seem to hear him. His eyes stare forward, his face pale with fear. The hills are closing in, seconds away now. I picture the jet driving over them, steady for a moment, before tipping end over end to explode in a fiery wreck. Cal would survive that, at least. But Cal won't let us die, not today. He leans hard on another lever, the veins in his fist standing out sharply. Then the hills fall away, like a cloth pulled off a table. It's not the island I see anymore, but the deep blue autumn sky. My breath disappears with the land, stolen away by the sensation of rising through the air. The pressure pushes me back into my seat and does something almost painful to my ears, popping them. Behind me, Killorn stifles a yelp, and Shade curses under his breath. Farley doesn't react at all. She's frozen, her eyes wide in shock. I've experienced many strange things these last few months, but nothing compares to flying. It's a jarring contrast, feeling the immense thrust of the plane as it ascends, every tick of the engines throwing us skyward, while my own body is so powerless, so passive, so dependent on the craft around me. It's worse than Cal's speeding cycle, but also better. Biting my lip, I make sure not to shut my eyes. We climb and climb, listening to nothing but roaring engines and our own pounding hearts. Wisps of cloud flit by, breaking across the cockpit like white curtains. I can't stop myself from leaning forward, almost pressing my nose to the glass to get a good look outside. The island wheels below, a drab green against the iron blue sea, growing smaller by the second, until I can't distinguish the runway or the barracks. When the jet levels out, reaching whatever height Cal decides on, he turns in his seat. The smug look on his face would make Maven proud.
"Well," he says, staring at Killorn, "can I fly this thing?"
A grumbled yes is all he gets, but that's enough for Cal. He turns back to the panel, hands resting on a U-shaped mechanism, centered before him. The jet responds to his touch, dipping gently when he turns the U. When he's satisfied, he punches a few more buttons on the console and leans back, seemingly letting the plane fly itself. He even unbuckles his safety belts, shrugging out of them to get more comfortable in his seat.
"So where are we heading?"
he asks the silence. "Or are we just winging it now?" I wince at the pun. A resounding smack
echoes through the jet as Killorn slaps a stack of papers against his knee.
Maps.
The colonel's, Killorn explains, his eyes boring into mine, trying to make me understand.
There's a landing strip near Harbor Bay.
But Cal shakes his head like an annoyed teacher with an increasingly foolish student.